Zombies! In honor of the Battle of Winterfell, what's your favorite cinematic battle scene?
I'm Katie Rich, and I know the popular answer is the Battle of Helm's Deep, but I like the Return of the King battle scene where Legolas slides down the elephant trunk, or whatever it's called. It looked fun.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with the news anchor battle from Anchorman, the one where Steve Carell throws a trident.
Hey, I'm Dave with the Seven, and it might be recency bias thanks to Patches in a previous episode, but I'll go with the lobby fight in The Matrix.
Katie?
David is still on this podcast.
Wait, I thought, does Katie gone yet?
Yeah, I go first every time. Right.
Have you ever been on this podcast?
No, where am I?
Welcome back.
Is this reply all? I have an internet complaint. I am David Ehrlich. Nothing really tops the Battle of Winterfell, which fucking ruled. The internet's stupid. But I will also go with a recent example. I think for wall-to-wall action in terms of battles, certainly of the historical variety, hard to top Dunkirk. Am I right? Dunkirk.
Which love that segment? Dunkirk.
All of it.
Oh,
everyone!
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 256, and it's the week of Wednesday, May 1st. On that day in 1941, Citizen Kane premiered. I feel like we've done this one before. We must have had a May 1st episode, because this feels familiar somehow.
My guess is that May 1st has happened before, not just this year. In fact, I know it because on that day in 1941, Citizen Kane premiered at New York.
We're not just time heisting ourselves back in a previous Fighting in the War Room episode.
Spoilers!
I know. We're going to talk about Avengers Endgame on this episode.
Don't spoil Endgame.
I don't think we're going to brazenly... we're just going to be like... talk about this movie. So if you haven't seen Endgame, you don't want to hear about it, maybe listen to this later, right? Before we even get into the reviews.
Right. Full spoilers.
If you haven't seen Endgame at this point, well, okay.
You already spoiled it. You just said time heist.
No. But let me slow this down. If you look down at your podcast app of choice that you're listening to this on, you'll see timestamps. The third segment, segment 3, Avengers Endgame spoiler talk, as it is labeled on your podcast device, will include Avengers Endgame spoilers. The other ones will include the topics listed.
But there might be Avengers Endgame spoilers in the other topics.
And this segment definitely includes
This segment includes Citizen Kane spoilers. So Rosebud is the sled. Hashtag don't spoil Citizen
don't spoil
Kane.
The sad
Sorry.
Thing is that I feel
don't
like
spoil the Rosebud.
We just meaningfully spoiled Citizen Kane for more people than we could have meaningfully spoiled Avengers Endgame for.
That's true. But before we get into spoilers on spoilers, I hear we have reviews that probably have no spoilers.
I believe we have, I don't know if we have reviews in the plural. I believe we have at least review in the singular in the American store. Anyway, from BLK Laptop, does that name ring a bell for those of you who were on this episode last week? No?
No.
Didn't think so.
No.
He says, or she says, or they say, even harder than is looks. I've been listening to the show for a while now and really enjoy your movie reviews. I always appreciated that you could double as fun conversation about film and serious criticism at the same time. Time heist, hashtag. But I didn't truly appreciate how tough that was until I started doing it. Don't worry, I respect you too much to plug anything. Oh, nice. I'm a newspaper reporter, it's very fancy, who recently started a film blog for the paper on top of my regular writing. And writing reviews is not easy. How do you make the plot and the bigger picture aspects of the movie digestible and fun to read? How do you drill down so effectively into what really matters? And how do you balance what's interesting to cover with what people actually want to read about? I'm still struggling with all that. Editor's note, so are we. And it only makes me appreciate the great work all of you do in that field. That's very kind. Between the podcast and your writings. Do they mean the work we do between the podcast and our writings? Like the
Which
tweets?
Does not work at all.
The tweets, I think, is what they mean.
Dinner I cooked last night? Thank you.
Thank you for appreciating our tweets. This review was very helpful, and for your actual meaning of that last sentence. The answer to your question,
how
as
you
I alluded
down,
to while
David?
Reading it, is that, first of all, it's I am hardly one to proffer any wisdom in that category, but I find that even by my own standards of success, it is getting harder with every review that I write. Instead of easier, the 10,000 hours thing is horseshit. I feel with every subsequent hour, I am less qualified to do this than I was the hour before. And maybe, I don't know. I think I just get, you know, you start hearing your own voice echoing in your head and writing yourself into corners that you've been in before and trying to say something new, trying to find ways of making a movie that you didn't find particularly interesting to read about remains the greatest challenge of my job. It is,
and it's all the people tweeting at you about what a bad critic you are, right?
That's that's just me and Dave.
Mostly Dave.
But also stop slopping down shit with these fat fucks.
Hashtag don't spoil Endgame, David.
But I do think the longer you do this, the more your brain just sort of turns to mud and all of these movies congeal into one giant movie.
Speak for yourself. I'm fresh faced.
All right. Yeah, no, I'm just talking about I'm walking into the next anyway. Decade.
If every movie congeals into one giant movie, isn't every movie the end game for
yes,
you?
Yes, it is.
That lifestyle.
Yes. That is why I felt so at home watching Avengers Endgame. Spoiler alert, I liked Avengers Endgame. Thank you for the review. Leave us some more reviews, you fucking ingrates. Jesus.
Drill down into this show. Yeah, David, tell us how much money Endgame made and then why it's bad.
I mean, listen. Endgame, it was discussed before Endgame came out that this could be the first movie to have a $1 billion opening weekend. And as far-fetched at the box office, and as far-fetched as that may have sounded at the time, that is indeed what came to pass. The movie actually had a $1.2 billion opening weekend, including $350 million plus the United States box office.
Was it really that far-fetched? How do we know off the top of our heads, like, what Infinity War made worldwide opening weekend?
I'm going to look that up while we talk.
Opening weekend worldwide, I'm not sure. In the United States, Avengers Endgame made $100 million more than Infinity War, which is pretty insane.
Wow.
Because ticket prices have not gone up that much, but, you know, they were not having 24-hour-a-day screenings at every AMC across the country.
Are you ready for this stat? This shocks me. Avengers Infinity War opened with $250 million domestically, which is pretty good. It opened with $630 million worldwide.
Wow.
It doubled its global opening weekend take.
Well, this is one of the biggest movies in China ever, pre-sales. Like,
right.
This was outselling. The hype was real. The don't spoil Endgame fever has definitely
Someone in Korea got like beaten within an inch of their life for spoiling the movie. Aggressively, but still, I'm not saying they deserved it.
Just as the Russos called for it.
Right. No, just as the Russos demanded. you know, there is, and I think the reason that I was called upon to open the segment is because I tweeted over the weekend something that, you know.
Wisely. Always tweet.
Always tweet. Yeah, it never goes wrong. I don't think this tweet went particularly wrong, but despite my demeanor on the show, as I was saying to people off pod, I actually do not enjoy upsetting people for the most part. A lot of the times things I say that I think in my head sound benign or are meant to be somewhat benign come off differently. Or at least
you're very Thanos-like, you know?
Right, yes.
Well-intentioned.
I'm exactly like Thanos. I tweeted about how, let's see, someone just retweeted my tweet so I can see right in front of me.
Oh my God. Cool, must be nice.
Yeah, you'll know this if you ever tweet something that anyone wants to share. Carol Lou, instead of just the dark universe all day long. Jesus. I kid. I love the dark universe tweets. Please never stop. I tweeted the Captain America meme from Spider-Man, Winter Soldier, whatever the fuck that movie's called.
That's right.
So the major corporation that's eating the rest of the entertainment industry alive made $1.2 billion at the box office this weekend, and you're celebrating it as personal validation of your fandom. Which was really, you know, an old refrain of mine, that may have taken on a more pointed feel this weekend. Whereas, you know, Netflix is not your friend, Disney is not your friend, none of these corporations are your friend, and it is all to the negative of the culture and the world at large when we celebrate their victories as our own, as I said, some sort of validation for your fandom. As someone was like, you just described all of sports, and my response to that was, as an obsessive New York Rangers fan, you know, when the Rangers win, or like one of the Avengers has a triumphant battle, I am very happy for them, and I guess happy for myself, especially in the case of the Rangers. But I'm not rooting for the Dolan family to make another $1 billion so they can jack up the ticket prices so that I can become even less affordable and I can, you know, not afford to go to a single game all year long.
Wait. No. Someone chase him down this metaphor. Why don't you stop watching hockey then?
I just explained.
Yeah, but what's
I'm not going to stop watching, like, okay. But I'm not admonishing anyone to stop watching Marvel.
You will give
I think you are on the side of the monolithic company your money. I am happy. I'm giving them the money. I'm just not cheering their windfall profit as a victory for myself or the culture.
But that's not how people see it. People aren't seeing it as
the... But this is what people were doing. People were going, holy cow, I made $1.2 billion. We did it. And it's like, no, you didn't.
Well, they're not saying we did it. They're saying
no, they are literally
this
saying
giant
that
thing
I
that
was
I'm
responding
invested
to.
In is validated.
This tweet was in a subtweet of Scott Mantz, who Jeffrey Wells accused of having a stake in this movie, which maybe
that's Scott Movie Mantz for the
Scott
record.
Scott Movie Mantz.
F you for not using his full name.
The tone of his tweet was basically like, we accomplished this, like, you know, doing victory laps. And maybe
he didn't fight in the Battle of Winterfell for you to forget his movie title, okay?
Maybe he is getting a payout from this, but the encroaching monoculture that we are getting towards is not good for anybody. Disney becoming the only purveyor of big screen movie experiences is not good for anybody. It's not good for movies. It's not good for fans in the long run, as rewarding as it might feel this weekend. They just laid off tens of thousands of people. Well, maybe not that many, but several thousand people. Fox is a big company.
Half of the planet
was snapped out of existence as a result of the Disney-Fox merger.
That's true.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm very excited for a lot of the things that Disney's doing. I'm also very not excited for a lot of the things that Disney's doing. Hashtag The Lion King remake. Dear God.
Closing Fox 2000. Like, you don't have to go into making bad movies. Like,
hashtag them never playing Alien at a rep screening ever again. So
that's
long
not true. That's not a true
It's a true fact because I just said it. But I am very excited to see the new Star Wars movie. I'm very excited to see whatever subsequent Star Wars movies they make. And I like Star Wars now, I guess, because The Last Jedi was good. And that's, I guess, what I'm excited that Disney's doing.
I mean,
I'm
conflicted here because I understand why people get invested. I was talking to some friends this weekend after reading about the box office receipts for Endgame and thinking about how... this was a weird conversation because people were asking me if Easter has just passed, and I do not come from a religious family, and I more and more I don't have many religious friends. What I'm getting at here is that I think as traditional religion fades, that people have honestly replaced these institutions that they invest in
with corporations,
properties they love. Yeah, and corporations, but they don't. I don't think. The same way a Christian person might think of their religion as one thing and the kind of Catholic Church or something as an institution, a money-making operation, a monolith, completely separate from their religion. I think that's how people think about Marvel or comic book characters that they are deeply invested in and the corporation behind them. So you can understand why a celebration of this, it's an achievement for them, and that number is a statement of how successful the achievement is. So you can understand why they get invested in that. And I don't know if you should take it away from them or not. It's like the Pope coming to your town.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say something deranged, and I'm going to go with a less violent example, or maybe not an example at all. But I understand why people do a lot of things, but it doesn't mean that I think those things are necessarily healthy. You know, as I followed that up by saying, you know, with great profits come great responsibility, and you know, David Sims, great friend, friend of the show, was saying, you know, that corporations often abuse their power, and I was like, well, that's exactly what I mean, and that. And the profits, and that, you know, when Aunt May says that to Spider-Man, she is not saying that having great power immediately confers great responsibility. The opposite is saying that, you know, having great power is often an opportunity, an open door to abusing that power. And I think that's the case when you have a company that is dominating and eating the film industry alive like this. It can be dangerous. I don't think we should be rooting for it. Tom Brueggemann, you know, not to plug my own website, I didn't write this article, wrote a very edifying article on IndieWire.com about why having a studio just eat everybody else's lunch is bad for culture at large. I agreed with every word that he wrote. I liked Avengers Endgame very, very much, much, much more than I ever expected I would. And that has absolutely no bearings on my feelings that it's terrifying to see a movie make this much money. And spare a thought for all of the underpaid AMC employees and the other, you know, big theater chains who were forced to work the 3:15 a.m. showings of Avengers Endgame. I hope the overtime was at least something. But yeah, it's
screening of Endgame. It wasn't at 3 a.m., but the popcorn machine broke at the concession stand. There were like six people gathered around it, and it was like the building was burning down. Like,
that was their Endgame.
It was a crisis.
And they Katie, what do you make of this? Is this bad?
Oh. If it's so bad, like I think David is saying, like, love the things that you love. Like, it's okay to be excited about this movie and excited that it succeeded, but I do think it's worth like pausing for a moment and saying Disney has reframed the parameters in a way that currently they're the only ones positioned to beat. I don't think it's gonna be that way forever, but to continue the sports metaphor, it's also not as if like the Rangers were buying up every other franchise in sports so that eventually you could only root for the Rangers.
There's also a salary cap in hockey, so no team can it's very even.
Hollywood,
there's a lot of parity.
Salary cap, this is what we need. Socialism.
Is this more like Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, so it's undeniably popular, but the outcome is going to be bad anyway?
I don't know if I can follow that metaphor all the way through.
But
Sanders just keeps coming to mind. I feel like I'm making trouble.
Looking forward, Kate. Look back.
I think it's all too easy to, at least from my way of thinking, without imputing that anyone who supports this movie and paid to see it over the weekend is akin to a Trump supporter. But I think those analogs are all too easy to make. I was trying to resist doing them. I will continue to do that. But I do think, that there is, and you see this in many arenas of life, that short-term satisfaction and these thrills, like, oh, I got this thing because this company grew big enough to give it to me, does not pay long-term dividends.
And Disney currently exists to give you that short-term thrill over and over and over again. Like, they're going to
keep succeeding with that
formula.
So when do you say no? Are you suggesting that people need to be more aware of this issue and
I don't think it hurts
seeing Marvel movies?
Well, I'm not going to ask them to do that because I think it's unreasonable. I mean, if they are making...
But if the corporation is bad, the problem is celebrating the money or giving them the money.
The problem is that Disney finds successful IPs, purchases the company, and then renews the success of those IPs, then we have problems way beyond Marvel.
It's like someone... No, Patches, you just asked a very relevant question. And I think it is the problem for me anyway is celebrating that Disney has this money. Someone literally, as we were recording this, just tweeted me 29 seconds ago, try telling this to kids who dressed up as their favorite superhero this past weekend. And it's like if a little kid came up to me and was like,
and David will.
Disney, I will. I will go door to door, so help me God. But if a little kid came up
make
to me
wish.
And was like,
how about wish Disney breaks up the banks, okay, man?
And was like, fucking, oh my God, Disney made $1.2 billion off Avengers. Robert Iger is going to be so excited. I would smack the candy out their mouth and be like,
hey,
what are you doing?
That kid needed to find that Robert Iger costume, okay? It didn't just show up at his door.
I think that loving Marvel and paying to see it on opening weekend is all well and good. I just think it's healthy to be mindful of
this,
the culture that we're all helping to create.
This tidbit needs to end on a Dave rant. I feel like Dave's gearing up.
The more you struggle in quicksand, the faster it pulls you up.
Whoa.
That's on Robert Iger's wall of his office. I am inevitable,
aspires.
Robert Iger.
I don't know if that metaphor is helpful in all situations, but sure. That wasn't the rant that Patch was looking for. It's very concise.
No.
It's like a cone.
He's saving the rant for the squirrel
section. I did the rant before when everybody was asking me, don't you want the Fox-Disney merger to go down because then the Fantastic Four will be around, and I did the rant then. But as somebody who's had experiences a long time with having a problematic relationship with loving parts of Disney, like extremely so, like Disney theme parks, I like love researching and hearing the history of still. You have to learn sometimes just to carve your little piece of pie out of the giant conglomerate and, fight the battles you could win.
Slow songs, they for skinny hoes. Can't move all of this, here to one of those. I'm a thick bitch.
Johnny Tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Okay, for our mini segment, we're taking a breath. We're coming up for air from Endgame talk to recommend something that will be hard to find on Netflix unless you go digging. And that is a new sketch comedy show called I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson. Tim Robinson, you probably don't remember that he was on Saturday Night Live, and he was a writer, and then he became a cast member for like one season, and then he did a rare thing where he went back to writing. I feel like he's just had a tumultuous career in trying to figure out what to do with his comedy, his strange, strange brand of comedy. I think if Saturday Night Live was all digital shorts, Tim Robinson would be a huge star. Unfortunately, it's not. They have to do like political humor and impressions and game show shit like that. And that is not what Tim Robinson does. You may have watched him on The Detroiters, the Comedy Central show. You may have been lucky enough to stumble upon another Netflix sketch series called The Characters, which was a really cool idea where a bunch of comedians got the budget for a single episode of a show and they went off and did crazy things. And Tim did what was basically the like pilot for I Think You Should Leave. It's really, really funny, and I recommend going and digging that up on Netflix. But I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson is pretty indescribable. It's just a bunch of sketches strung together. It's six episodes. Each is about 15 to 17 minutes long. And I really want to ask Katie, because Katie, I was like, Katie, you must watch the show. By the way, all the episodes are directed by Akiva Schaefer of Lonely Island and this woman, Alice Matthias. They're written by Tim and this guy, Zach Cannon and John Solomon. And so you can get the idea of these like Lonely Island-esque digital shorts, but they're more in the vein of if one of my favorite Lonely Island shorts is this sketch called Lettuce. I think it was like their second digital short on SNL. That is the vibe of I Think You Should Leave. In Lettuce, I think it's just Will Forte and just eating a head of lettuce. That is the sketch. And that is right up Tim Robinson's alley. I'm sure it inspired him. But Katie, I made you watch at least one of these episodes. And the first one, which is 15 minutes long. The first sketch of the show is about a guy at a job interview. And he's getting really tense and worried. He's trying to sound really cool. So he's leaving the diner they're at, and he insists that the door, the exit door, opens inward, but it opens outward. And to prove that he's cool and that he is fit for this job, he tries to open the door inward. Now, that's not funny with me describing it. You should watch it. But Katie, you saw this sketch, and you said that this was like very my brain, and I want you to unpack that as a sell for I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson.
I mean, I don't know if I know how to sell it as for the show. The show did make me laugh. I was more just thinking about how like Tim and Eric stuff is where I think of your sense of humor and like sketches that just escalate, like, you know, eating a head of lettuce is something that's not supposed to be funny and then suddenly becomes that. And then there's a lot of that in this show, which I laughed at sometimes. Like, there's a sketch with Vanessa Bayer that we've been talking about where she continually fails to make the properly self-deprecating Instagram post, which is really funny. And then there's like a lawyer ad where he's describing a completely insane situation with like plumbers like ruining his toilet and giving it a hole that's only the right size for farts, which is funny. I don't know, like your sense
mud
of humor,
pies, I believe, is
mud pies is a very frequently used phrase in this episode, which is where I was kind of like, I don't know if I'm going to keep going along this route.
Really? Mud pies is what got you.
Okay. I was just like, it's not that funny. And then they kept repeating it over and over.
That's pretty
again.
Funny.
I think a big selling point is these are 15 minute long episodes on Netflix. So when you're like sitting there, I love something that is short when I have a tiny window of time to fill. And so if sketch comedy like this is your thing, and I feel like it's more of a mixed bag for me, it's, you know, worth checking out. And hopefully Netflix serves it to people in that way. It seems like a really useful thing to have like in between their, you know, endless seasons of Stranger Things.
Patches, how many of these episodes have you watched?
I watched all six.
Okay.
In two nights. I took a break, but
so from what I could tell from also just watching the first episode, it doesn't necessarily have like a thematic or heralded structure.
It's truly like Chappelle Show-esque.
Given that, what percentage did you as somebody this series is for like of the entire runtime of the series?
I would say 80% of the sketches. What's interesting about Tim Robinson is that because he was a writer, I think the sketches are really sharp, and every every line is speaking to the joke premise. But he is actually a hilarious performer, and he gets a bunch of his friends to come in and do some of the sketches. Andy Samberg shows up in one. Tim Heidecker, Katie, you mentioned Tim and Eric. Tim Heidecker does show up, basically playing our colleague Jordan Hoffman, in a playing a game of celebrity, but every celebrity he picks is an esoteric jazz figure from like the 1970s, and he's condescending everyone for picking like Robert Downey Jr. and shit like that. Very funny sketch. But Tim,
that is very Jordan Hoffman.
Yeah, the best sketches are actually Tim Robinson starring in them and like screaming his head off. There's a sketch about laser back surgery that starts as a commercial, and then it becomes Tim Robinson being like, you know, it's like an old man getting laser surgery. I can dance with my wife again. An old lady gets laser surgery. I can garden my garden again. And then Tim Robinson pops up. He's like, I can beat the shit out of my ex-wife's new boyfriend. And it goes from there. I mean, the man can scream, the man can be frustrated, the man can go completely off the rails. He's really comically funny when he is, and he can be really exaggerated. And I feel like we don't have a Chris Farley today, we don't have a Jim Carrey today, and oddly enough, I think Tim Robinson is kind of filling that void for me, and it's really refreshing to see that when I feel like most comedy right now is stuck in a political spectrum. It's stuck trying to say something deeper. You know, I remember I loved Amy Schumer's show. I loved Inside Amy Schumer, especially maybe that second season when it was really hitting its stride. And I love all of Chappelle's show. And then I think Schumer got like too aware of her social position, and her comedy has really changed over the years when she's kind of taken on some weight to that sounds wrong, I shouldn't say that. There's weight on her shoulders. There's weight on her shoulders.
And just like that,
I know. I'm canceled.
Cancel me.
Fighting in the Room got canceled again. I can't believe
we canceled Patrick.
Can't believe I got canceled.
The canceling came from within the podcast.
There's weight on her shoulders to speak to bigger issues, which is fine. It's necessary. Like, it's good that people can talk about everything, but like, I do like that Tim Robinson's sketch show is totally esoteric, and not it's speaking to the human experience and the human frustrations. So if you need catharsis in the form of a wild person, I would watch I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson.
So after seeing Infinity War on a plane and watching Ant-Man and the Wasp last weekend, I decided to get with the current times with the Marvel Cinematic Universe and went and saw Endgame on Thursday night with a very delightful crowd of people who cheered in all the right moments and were pretty quiet throughout when they needed to be. And it was a really good movie-going experience. I'd kind of forgotten how much I enjoyed them. And even though I said as we started the show that I've kind of forgotten what happened in Endgame because there was a whole hour and a half Game of Thrones and, you know, among life over the weekend in between, I mostly remember what happened. And as I tweeted after I got out of the movie, basically it was Back to the Future 2, but with superheroes, which is so extremely my thing that I was so excited. There's a lot else going on in Endgame, which we'll get into, but the entire time heist concept and all of the jumping around in previous movies, both I really enjoyed and got me weirdly emotional about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is not something I ever expected. I learned that the shot of all the Avengers in one place from the 2012 Avengers movie, like, makes me nostalgic, which I never would have expected. And I think that's a big part of the power of this movie and why it's become so huge is that there's all of these external emotions tied up in this franchise, and that it actually made a pretty successful movie to go with it. We haven't actually talked amongst ourselves about this movie at all, so I don't even know where we want to go from here.
On this podcast, we stan the Battle of New York.
That's just
what it is. I was tempted to answer that for the lightning round question. Patches wrote the definitive piece about the making of that sequence. I lost my mind. It turns out one of my favorite things is when I'm trying to think of other examples of this. I know there are a few, but the one that comes to mind is in Metal Gear Solid 4, a video game of all things. But when a piece of entertainment, preferably a movie, revisits a previous installment in some meta commentary sort of way.
Back to the Future.
No, but two. Like better than Back to the Future too. Like, and also maybe you. more recent. There are examples. I can't think of them right now. And I think probably happens in TV maybe more than films because of serialized reasons. But when they went back in time to the Battle of New York and added all these fun flourishes around it, I was in heaven.
Me too.
Loved it.
The whole movie could have been Battle of New York flashbacks as far as
I thought it would have been more of that.
And
actually,
they were, I was reading in the New York Times today in the interview they did with, his name? The screenwriters did.
McFeely.
No, I know their names. I can't remember the name of the writer who
Dave
did it for the New York Times.
David Scott,
there
yeah.
you go. I can tell you his Twitter bio, but not his name. That's the way the world works.
You're a broken man.
I am a very broken man. They were saying that they initially weren't going to include the Battle from New York scene because it seemed too obvious. It was too iconic of an Avengers moment. And then I was like, no, that's precisely why it works so well and why I like the Thor bit a little bit less, because this is so much about the brand and like the iconic moments from this franchise and, you know, how it exists in the culture. It is. I mean, life and death is not really relevant in these movies so much as, you know, the life and death of these brands and the, you know, we measure the lifespan by contracts and so on. I thought going back to the Battle of New York was brilliant and one of my favorite things about a movie that I liked a lot.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was shocked because I don't like Infinity War.
Bad movie.
It's just an overstuffed, it's really boring. You know, it hasn't held up. It's been worse watching it again. I also watched it on a plane recently. It's just not, it has no life to it, and it's not an action movie, and it can't find room for real character.
It has like this endless hunt for the stones, but somehow doesn't actually feel like an effortful heist the way that this one does. It just feels like a scene and then another scene and on forever.
Is that expectation so low for this one? That was smart.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's it. Maybe that has something to do with why I was completely spellbound and just like I got really into Tony Stark Iron Man for the first time.
Probably, oh my god!
Probably
you maybe
that ever.
Guy. Yeah. He's so good in this.
I actually don't really care for the first Iron Man movie. I haven't seen it in years, but I didn't really like it when it first came out. I hate Iron Man 2, and I really dig Iron Man 3 because he comes more alive for me. But he's the Tony Stark Iron Man character is interesting because you'd think that because he's been here since the beginning that he would have the biggest arc or the most emotional lift going into this kind of finale moment. But I find his story to be really broken up into chunks. I think we talked about this in our little prelude episode to Endgame. But he, you know, his Iron Man trilogy has been over for so long. You know, he's conquered. He was dealing, I guess, with alcoholism a little bit, but mostly PTSD from the Battle of New York or whatever. And just like I didn't go into Infinity War feeling like there was an emotional heft to Iron Man and that he was dealing with the looming threat of Thanos. I was much more invested in Chris Evans playing Captain America because it feels like his displacement from his era, from time, has always been part of his story. And he's been existentially tormented by what being a hero is all about in the present day. And then S.H.I.E.L.D., what happened to S.H.I.E.L.D. being upended. And then the conflict with Tony Stark, his opponent in Civil War. I don't even like Captain America Civil War, and I'm into Chris Evans and Steve Rogers and everything they're dealing with. So there's a lot on the table to see the whole kind of movie rest on Captain America's shoulders. But suddenly, Iron Man matters. That scene where he comes back from space and he's like emaciated and yelling at Steve and being like, fuck you guys, we can't do anything, it's over, we lost. I was really pretty affected by that.
And the way
solving the problem.
Like, he's dealing with the sense of loss in there, and then as it goes forward, you see Black Widow, like, trying to hang on to a purpose in this world that really feels purposeless for so many people.
Well, especially her, because she has no purpose, and
right,
she's completely underserved by the MCU.
Well, we can get into that.
Franchise done her dirty.
But she's really good in those early scenes of, like, coping with loss in that way, and, like, I'm sure that there are takes out there about the way that this movie depicts grief in the beginning of it, and I thought it was surprisingly raw for this movie to go through.
I would have, I mean, you know, again, the bar is very, very low for real emotions existing in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I did think that there was, you know, that leftovers vibe that you see in the first hour of this movie, I think plays very well in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I would have happily watched another hour of that. You know, it starts to pull your collar a little bit when they get into the Pym particle and the quantum realm and all that bullshit to do the inevitable. But I did think that the character work was really strong. in the first half. And I think that, you know, it's something I wrote about on IndieWire at length, was about failure and how this, you know, we have these indomitable superheroes who are so strong. But I think the fascinating thing about this, and maybe this is a recurring thing in the comic books, I don't know, is how this movie really refocuses the MCU as being this portrait of failure and the way that it cows people or doesn't. And how the sort of the ethos that the perfect is the enemy of the good, and all these people, you know, in trying in their own way and often in perpendicular ways to be their best selves, and realizing the flaws contained within that thinking, and how someone like Thanos, someone like Ultron, these are people who don't have wiggle room for that kind of compromise and, you know, or for the humanity that it allows for. And I think that the Avengers have finally become interesting foils for that in this movie.
I want to throw to Dave, because I know he, kind of surprising for me at least, has more complaints about this, but I don't know what they are. But David and Patrick, do you want to just like say what maybe grabbed you the most in this movie? Like, what was like the biggest selling point for you before we then turn negative with Dave?
You mean like what got me to the finish line saying that it was still a good movie?
Yeah, like what, hours? Like what was the part of the movie that you just like won you over the most? Like for me, it was the big arrival at the very end where all the other heroes show up, like the most inevitable moment of the whole movie that still completely got me.
Oh, that part didn't do much for me. Although I liked the score for the first time in this movie. Alan Silvestri going full like 90s prestige. It sounds like Forrest Gump or something. It's actually very peculiar, but I'm really a hard stan for Captain America. So when he gets to wield Mjolnir, I was right. All
yeah.
About
that. You're a hard
my theater lost its mind. When
I'm
that
a hard
happened.
Stan.
Yeah, you know what? You know, Age of Ultron has been on TV a lot this week, and I think
it's a good movie. Can I just say this? That Age of Ultron is probably the best Avengers movie.
Okay, that's fucking
what?
Crazy.
Better than the Avengers.
We stand.
Yes,
the
it's
Avengers
better than the Avengers,
on this podcast.
But because the Avengers is not just the Battle of New York.
Yeah, the Avengers.
A whole
I know,
first
but
half
the
it is
no,
not good.
But the after the first 30 minutes, the Avengers really, really soars. But I do think the Age of Ultron had a lot more going on than it felt at the time when it was more in a vacuum. And I think especially seeing some of those themes reflected in Endgame, they pay off really well. That movie is clearly an invaluable piece in the franchise.
Dave, how'd you like Endgame?
Yeah, it's fine.
What
I mean, you guys
like
are right,
it?
And I'm glad you did that right before throwing to me that it's Age of Ultron Part 2, which is good, except that we had so many movies in between there, and Infinity War, which seemed like it was building to something else. So it's, I feel like it's the same complaint I had on this podcast way back when everybody liked Captain America the Winter Soldier.
Not me.
Better than I did, and my stance was that it had a lot of the same problems as Iron Man 2. It just had a little bit more panache in like pulling it off. I feel like Endgame has a good movie that is a conclusion to a 22-film arc in there. And I think that feeding off that high and then also having lived through all these movies being released is sort of combining with what David was disgusted with in the first segment, which is just like the feeling that the entire world is monetarily behind this machine, if not necessarily, you know, Rotten Tomatoes behind this machine. And it's sort of adding the shine to this movie that I think when you look back at it is sort of a victory lap too soon. So a lot of the stuff that reads, I guess, to people as, you know, like good moments or returning to the Battle of New York or finally like a moment to have Frigga do something feels to me like some sort of like little bits of retcon squeezed in that feel just as forced as all the female heroes helping Captain Marvel move the gauntlet 100 yards at the end of the movie. And so I feel like they stopped and said, look what we did, and then also changed a few mistakes to the point that we revisited Thor the Dark World for one of our three time travel locations we get to revisit. One of them becomes Thor the Dark World. Four time travel locations, because they hide the fact that the only important one is 1970s, so we could wrap up the parenthood father arc for Tony Stark before he has to die. It just all seems a little sloppy in a world that you built a cinematic universe with all these character heroes with arcs, and as David said, like this through line of failure, and then to introduce like this amazing villain with six MacGuffins that could literally do anything anytime you want.
Wait, what amazing villain?
I think Thanos is like a villain with an arc that has like a point.
He's a character. He gives a performance.
I
liked when he was a purple space farmer for a minute.
I liked when he ran his hand through the space core.
I imagine that you, after you ruin people's lives with your tweets, David, like you take this joy and you go to your retreat to your space.
I hang up my armor on a stick. I go and I make some taters.
Yeah. Seems great.
Even Space Farmer at the beginning at least has a compelling, consistent argument. At the end of the movie, they have to give him a monologue because that's where you'd have the villain monologue. But at that point, you spent over 2.5 hours forgetting he was a formidable force. So it's kind of wasted. And then you just get what Marvel's really good at, but is what it is, which is 50 different people on green screens over 60 days of production slammed into 10 minutes of footage that has been previs to the point to give you exactly what you need, where Rescue flies in front of giant Ant-Man, even though none of these people even knew they were in the same scene with each other.
Look,
it's fine, but it is what it is. Let's not pretend like they pulled off this 22 film arc. They did what they always did, which is made the best of what they had and made a ton of money off of it.
I will say this, that I think you're right. Like, I don't think that the end battle, the splashiest scenes, the everyone is together, Marvel Universe fighting evil forces, the Lord of the Rings part of this movie is that successful. And I have found myself in the days after seeing it feeling like the way that Thanos was handled, short drift, characters who were actually intrinsically tied to him. At the end of the day, Thanos is a character that's directly connected to Nebula and Gamora and Drax and the Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, Thanos murdered Drax's family, at least in the lore of this movie. And I'm not saying you have to care about that or carry that knowledge into this movie, but it is true. And it feels like not everyone gets a payoff when you have a 22-movie arc and you basically write this movie as Tony Stark and Captain America's send-off, then the best parts of this movie are going to be when they're fighting Thanos.
But
when they are having emotional payoff, everyone else is gravy, and there's too much gravy at the end.
I think Nebula got what you're
Nebula
talking
is great.
You know. She has a really great role.
But I don't think
Gamora is a better argument there.
Who is Gamora? I don't think that's
Gamora.
That is an Infinity War reference, maybe the only one I know. But I don't think it's an accident that we all like this movie more because for the vast majority of its running time, it just cuts away everyone except for the core Avengers.
Yes, absolutely.
And like that is like – I don't give – I mean there's so many characters in this universe that I think are really valuable for like fun one-liners, but I don't – fundamentally have that same investment in, and with them sort of out of the way, we could really realize the value of these characters that had such chemistry in the first place. Although I did, as disappointing, you know, the Russo brothers, I don't really, the action they put together, it was a little bit more coherent here than it's been in some previous movies, but again, as Patches was laying out, it's the CG overload where you can tell they're not actually sharing the same physical space. Right. It's just like a moving poster. I mean, it's...
Well, it's not even like that. Even at the funeral, like, it's clearly everyone's green screen. They couldn't get everyone for a tracking shot lakeside.
You know? Yeah, that's... but I can't believe that this was my reaction. I mean, but you know, this is why they play the games. This is why the movies are surprising. I think the biggest thrill I got from seeing someone suit up was fucking Pepper Potts.
Yeah.
I had just watched Iron Man 3 again in preparation for that piece I wrote. And Iron Man 3 rules. And is really one of the best movies in the MCU. I suppose also because it's one of the most assembly line movies in the MCU. Shane Black really put a stamp on it. And it really sort of endeared me to Pepper Potts as a character and got me back on board with her relationship with Tony. And I just loved seeing her green screen to hell and back suit up and fight for a couple frames. Although it was really cool. I was really into it.
I loved seeing all the people of Wakanda walk out of some weird, like, CGI, golden halo thing, and then all the girls in the row in front of me screaming for Shuri. Like, that, the value of that kind of transcends, like, how weird and CGI it looked. Although I do think it worked way better as a battle scene than the big battle in Infinity War, and I can't even put my finger on why.
Again, low bar. Low bar.
Why does it work so differently? Because in theory it should be the same.
There's nothing really emotion, like,
I think there's more components. I think there's more splash pages and more art to it than the mess of CG beasts being fought in a big battle.
The big fight in Wakanda in Infinity War is really just a giant stall for time. None of the combatants are meaningfully paired off. There's way too much going on between the fight on Titan and Vision being tended to like right above the battlefield. It's just a lot, and like the Hulk looks really stupid and not in a funny way in the fucking armor. It's a really just a dumb visual, and I'm mad about it. Like, it actually makes me upset to look at, like looking at something ugly. The Hulkbuster armor is dumb to begin with, and that's just like double dumb. And that's a big failing of Age of Ultron. These are like my deep seated issues with the MCU. I think just the scale is so all over the place in Infinity War when you have these human characters going to this distant alien moon, and suddenly someone's throwing moons at them. It's a lot. But, like, this is such a culmination. I mean, it's like everything that happens in the fight is just sort of going through the motions. It's, as Katie said, the real thrill is seeing all the various properties enter together into the shared space where Marvel is just saying, look at the size of this cinematic universe we created, look at all these characters, right? You like,
but
they're,
I think,
all here.
The success of Endgame, I think this movie is really a victory lap for Marcus and McFeely and the screenplay, these writers who have been with with at least Captain America since the first Avenger. And I think a lot about what works so well in Mission Impossible Fallout, why that's a writer's action movie. It's a writer's tentpole blockbuster. This is not as successful because it's the Russos and, you know, not a singular voice, but this movie is all about cleverness. It's all about being ingenious about how are they going to get the Infinity Stones? We know they're going to defeat Thanos. And this is all of the Marvel movies inevitably because they're all working under comic book logic where we know the ending as soon as the movie starts. But, this is one of the most clever Marvel movies ever, and from making Smart Hulk, like, there's just so many little
Smart
bits
Hulk is
of
so
how they're
good.
Advancing.
It looks so good.
Yeah, he freaks me out, actually. He looks so much like
Mark Ruffalo.
Mark Ruffalo.
I thought they did such a great, I mean, I would love to hear Dave on it. I thought they did such a great job with Smart Hulk.
All the polygons.
Yeah, no, Ruffalo Hulk's really good. I kept waiting for him to do more spotlight poses, because he definitely has the Mark Ruffalo mouth. And even in places where, if I were to be choosing performances, I'd be like, maybe one where Hulk doesn't look like he's, where we could tell what Hulk's thinking, but it actually works all compiled together. Even though I think initially a shock to just hear Mark Ruffalo's voice come out of that version of the Hulk.
That's so good.
By the end when he's, or by the New York time travel part, oh, where he has to pretend to smash things.
Ugh.
It's really all coming together.
Smash.
But it's going to be a much more fun Hulk for him to play in the future.
What did you guys think of jumping ahead 5 years? I thought that was a really interesting,
people in my theater
decision.
Gassed when that title
came
up.
Loved it, except for I just could not deal with it. Like, I understand why they did it, and I think it probably works, and so I don't want to grudge them it too much. But has any title card in cinema history been more full of itself than the 5 years?
One
oh my god, that means like 30 seconds of screen time.
Later.
You're like, 5 years what? I don't know. I can
5 years earlier?
Shit. And then you come back in,
twist.
You'll still be doing this. Like, it's Jesus Christ. But once we got out of that nightmare, I thought that it was really effective because
you just missed the Mets.
You missed the Mets. The Rangers are all still alive, thank God. I don't know the odds are that. I honestly feel like it's more likely that just enough of the Mets were disappeared that they had to just spread out the team. But I feel like in that case, the league would have, in order to stay on its feet, unless MLB entirely is out of business, would have done what they do when, like, this is tragic, but like a plane crashes in a sports league, like happened in the KHL a few years ago in Russia, where they distribute players from the other team to the team that has been
eradicated. And
I thought the idea was that people were just too depressed with the world to bother to go see baseball.
But doesn't like
baseball's already such a drag.
Russo says we miss the Mets.
Yeah,
miss the Mets.
And I feel like. I feel like baseball would have survived the snap in general. Like people,
Met got snapped himself.
Mr. Met is definitely dead. No, all of the Mets All Stars are gone, and Mr. Met's there fine, and people are outraged at Thanos. So I had some questions about that, but I did generally like that. I loved. I'm not sure if I loved how it was handled, but I loved the idea of Tony finally getting this reprieve from his neuroses, getting the life that he wanted and never thought possible. And being so sensitive to the idea of people bringing up what had happened and his failure with Thanos, and then having to juggle and make sense of it. Like he has this need to be up in the middle of the night and solve this problem and make things right. But the idea of it is so painful. I wish they had labored a little bit more on the idea that bringing everyone back would have potentially taken his daughter away rather than him just knowing from the start that he would find a way to keep them both, because I feel like that sort of cheats him out of a big emotional pivot. But, I like the idea of it.
Yeah, I was thinking about, like, if I could go back in time 5 years ago and, like, prevent Trump being elected or something, and it'd be like, okay, well, you still get to have a kid, but you don't have the kid that you have now. Like, what? Like, how, like, what a personal decision that would be. And they're kind of fainting at that, but that is one of the emotional beats they don't totally have time to
do. They just go like, oh no, you'll totally have the same kid, it's fine.
And then they have to come back to this.
Well, the whole logic is like, you snap your fingers with this gauntlet on and anything can happen. Like, I like that they kind of keep it that easy, that they don't have to like learn how to use the Infinity Gauntlet. They just snap.
They could have kept it easier, Katie.
By
even easier.
By what?
Just why worry about like the quantum realm?
Wait, but that's how they do the time travel. You mean like
they would have
I'm saying like when you've already introduced six stones that could do anything.
Oh, like and they could have invented a time machine.
You have the audience in the place where it's just like, yeah, sure.
But it's so satisfying that like, I mean, I know Ant-Man and the Wasp was so recently that like it's not like some long gestating, you know, payoff, but that you have Paul Rudd coming back and you have him taking the knowledge that he's used. Like, even though we've pared down to the original Avengers, I really like his role with the group in this movie.
Can someone, wait, can
and
you
And I like the rat that brought
that?
Him back. Wait, did I,
the
like,
rat's
did
great.
I like Paul Rudd?
No, can you? I mean, we all like Paul Rudd, I would hope. But can you? I was just thinking about how, you know, it's maybe not the most guaranteed thing in the world. There's going to be another Ant-Man movie. And I feel like, as much as Endgame reinforced positive feelings towards Captain America, and even surprisingly for me, an avowed Tony Stark hater, Tony Stark, that I really came away from it being like, Ant-Man was really useless in all this. And I don't mean just like what he does in the movies. I just mean like emotionally what he brings to the texture of the story. But I'm happy to be proven wrong.
I feel like he's just the
useful. He has a daughter and a girlfriend he needs to get back. And at the end, they all watch fireworks together.
They do.
These things are true. It punched me when he showed up at his house and his daughter
was
growing up. Oh, yeah,
me too. I think he works. Like, he's a good audience surrogate. Like that, he's in there, kind of like watching how the rules of time travel play out, and kind of thinking the same things that you are. At this point, we don't necessarily need an audience surrogate. Like, we know all of these people. Tony Stark has been that character in the past, but I like him as someone who's kind of, you know, in the proceedings in the same way that I might be, kind of like taken along for the ride. Like he's in, because he's in. He goes through the Battle of New York, which is somewhere he wasn't before. So it's like fun to think about him, like suddenly being part of that story. I mean, kind of the same with Nebula, even though she has like a really more emotional role to play. Like seeing her in the mix with all of this was fun too.
I just wish that Ant-Man hadn't felt like so much of a cog. And like, there's a, you know, the way that Paul Rudd plays them is this really sort of like laid back, casual energy, which runs counter to the Paul Rudd that I really love. So I don't know.
Energy.
What's
he
the
spends
Paul Rudd
the first
you love?
Half of this movie screaming about time travel and how.
No, I know, but like, you know, Paul Rudd is just like, he's like, hey guys, I'm Ant-Man.
He gets turned
like,
into a baby.
I was in prison, whatever. Yeah, that whole stuff is dumb. You know what I did love though, because as someone whose favorite moment in the entire MCU is, I had a date. Last shot of this movie.
Yeah.
Great.
I really can't believe that's the last shot of the movie. Like, it's the same with Infinity War. It ends on Thanos smiling. Like, that's kind of a cool, bold thing for that movie to do. And I love that that's how this one ended.
He got his dance. Loved it.
Patrick, so you must
satisfying.
Have been happy.
I was so weepy. First off, Tony dying and Happy Hogan talking about hamburgers with his daughter I was weeping. I
it's all the, this movie nails the kids stuff. That's like the, like all the John Slattery scenes I really loved.
But I'm just so happy for Captain America. I found the whole thing really fulfilling. And I think the amazing thing about this movie is that it's still really fun. I think the stakes are high. That opening scene where Hawkeye loses his whole family is total gut punch too. I was really affected by that. And
then he becomes a terrorist in Japan.
Yeah.
That part's weird.
That part is weird. He's only murdering weird stereotypes that we should be moving on beyond in movies like
Hiroyuki
this.
Sanada. They're fighting. I was like, wait, has this character been introduced before? What is happening?
Yeah. No, that's the go to the bathroom
Thor
time.
3.
Yeah, jeez. No, that part is bad. But that there's room for so much comedy and fun and like banter between, again, those original Avengers. Or even not the original, like Don Cheadle seems more present in this movie than I ever remember. Or as you said, Katie, Nebula is a big part of this movie and her arc and confronting her past self, you know, opening that can of worms of time travel. It seems like such a risk. I still think it's like people are confused. They don't understand the time travel logic of this movie at all because things aren't acting like Back to the Future. You can't change the future. And that's really a dangerous narrative tool to be meddling in, and yet it makes
their entire
emotional
where
sense.
Their point in existing is to find a way to do that without doing Back to the Future, and still they can't be successful.
No.
Good.
It's not. Yeah, you could argue it's not successful at all, but it's emotionally successful, and mm-hmm. we know exactly what happened when Steve Rogers disappears into the quantum realm, and then 2 seconds later he's on a bench, and it's so satisfying. He made a choice, and the camera move. I think about the camera move a lot because I think they kind of glide from Falcon and Winter Soldier, all of them standing there, over to the bench. And in that amount of time, an entire lifetime, Steve Rogers' entire life has passed in a different timeline. We're now actually in a different linear version of time itself, and there's no evidence of it. It's like Westworld or something.
Time travel is always tricky. The lack of a butterfly effect at all is a lot to process in the moment, but I don't feel like unlike watching Primer or like even a Christopher Nolan movie, which is less time travel and just putting together the chronology of it all, I sort of just let this wash over me. I wasn't, you know, the emotional logic is all I really needed to take
totally
from one
agree.
Place to the other.
Let me wrap up by asking you this question.
Wait, can we talk about Captain Marvel for a second?
Yes, sure. She's barely in the movie.
Yeah, but she sucks every second she's there. I hate to throw my
lot. You don't like
in.
The other you don't like Captain Marvel, the full length feature film either.
No, it's god awful. But I think like in this movie, which was shot before Captain Marvel, and so I don't want to really lay that at its feet. But I really hate to throw my hat in with the incels, and I would like to think that I don't like the Captain Marvel they've created so far for very different reasons. I think as the one gratuitous pandering all women superhero shot in this movie suggests, there are so many strong female characters, and not strong, I don't mean strong female characters in the traditional sense, but like maybe I do, I don't know, but there are a lot of really like characters that I think people really like that have like great personalities and great stories to tell. And Captain Marvel so far, with a whole movie on her own and a bullshit role as a Brie Larson ex machina in this one, is not one of them. I just find that whole character a complete non-entity, and I think seeing like 10 there was so much crowing about her being this first Marvel female superhero who have her own movie, but seeing 10 women together in a single shot, however many it is, all of whom I'd rather see a movie about than Captain Marvel, I just feel like they need to save this character if the next iteration of the MCU is going to have any life to it.
I feel like Okoye, or how do you pronounce her name? Is that
Okoye?
Right? Okoye. She got a little shafted in this movie. Where was she? She was on the Black Widow team. She should have been fighting alongside the Avengers. Where was she? There was a whole poster dispute. I thought that was really odd that Disney eventually put her on the top of the poster and then did not give her an actual role in the movie.
I mean, she had Wakanda to defend. It's like Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel's got other galaxies to defend. Okoye has Wakanda
more.
To work on.
I wanted more.
I think this movie sold me on Captain Marvel a little bit more because it kind of put her military stiffness in the context of all these other characters. Like, I like that in the shot of the funeral at the very end, she's like standing watch at the steps of the house while everyone else is standing there being emotional. It kind of did more for her character than I expected. And like, I liked Captain Marvel, but but it was hard for me to like see where the character was among the stiffness of the performance. Mm. I felt like at times, and in this movie it felt like it made more sense.
Yeah, and I like that she goes off and says, you know, you're not the only planet in the universe. I need to help other people. That was a logic that held why she needed to go away and then come in the middle of the
battle. That logic does hold, but she was not missed. And they are, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of talk about how the character is too powerful. Maybe. Giving I don't you know. A look.
Dave Let's likes see, Captain guess, Marvel.
Dave, cut to Dave. I'm looking at Dave was vaping earlier. I saw him on the screen. Man, that this felt like a backward step from A Bad Place to begin with. Oh. Even though I know they shot this first, the burden is on the next Captain Marvel movie. That's all I'm going to say. There's so much personality. There's more personality in individual shots.
He showed up exactly when Superman shows up in a fight. It's fine. Like, everybody, welcome to what it's like to read Marvel Comics event to event, where every 3 years the absolute most momentous thing ever happens, and then 2 months later we still have to all buy the same Marvel comic book, which is fine. Like, some of my favorite Marvel events are like huge overblown things by like Jonathan Hickman's Infinity that led to Secret Wars is basically all these same players but making like hard world killing decisions moving forward, and that's some of my favorite Avengers. But that being said, I like Endgame is this like momentous feeling thing that I think is going to melt away slightly from people as they realize that this is the new pattern. If the Marvel Cinematic Universe goes forward, is that every 10 years you're going to get something this momentous. What I'm hoping is that this doesn't become a pattern that means we can't have smaller story arcs closing off in between.
I can't imagine they do this again. It's hard to imagine a movie of this scale ever again.
Like everybody?
I just can't see it. Well, first off, it's going to be hard to establish these characters who have already been established, Black Panther, Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange, I guess. Like, I don't think they're ever going to feel like the original Avengers in that build up to the 2012 movie, which is so fundamental to pulling this movie off.
Well, because that felt so like they couldn't pull it off. Like, we didn't know that it would work then, and now there's not that element of doubt.
Like, I don't think it's going to get bigger than an Age of Ultron, if you will. Like, I think we'll get the all-female team-up movie before we get all of the new Avengers.
But I feel like what I'm saying, it's going to come. I'm talking about in the long-distance future. Like, where the real money is what you're talking about, is, like, smaller movies that feel like the Avengers that aren't, you know, put Namor in Black Panther 2 because he's, you know, causing the earthquakes off the coast of Africa. You know, throw somebody into Doctor Strange, like have Victor Von Doom be like one of the anti-wizards in Doctor Strange 2. That's how it's going to
stop
expand.
Stop getting David but too excited for the next stage of Marvel.
They are going to
have the Baxter Building show up in Spider-Man Far From Home.
It would take a lot of work to earn, like, another 22 movies with a very particular endgame in mind to earn this sort of spectacle.
Endgame 2.
I don't think they're going to do that thing where they forecast where here it is, but I do think there are threats in the Marvel universe that you can treat as everything threats, where it gets weird now that we've had the Avengers in a storytelling world. Like, everybody was asking after Iron Man 3, why doesn't Iron Man call the Avengers? And they had to like tiptoe around it and like re-threat assess to like this Tony Stark needs a suit of armor around the world. Those story decisions are organic, being made film to film, and I don't see how that doesn't culminate in a huge movie to try to make another $1 billion in an opening weekend. Right. Just why not try it like 10 years from now?
Katie, let me ask you, here's my wrap-up question. I want to get ahead of a conversation, actually. Oh, we're going to be on the forefront of a conversation.
Are you about to start an entirely different conversation?
No.
I don't know.
I know we've gone long, but this is important. This is important. So I think, you know, there's a lot of positive reactions to Endgame. Seems like people are amazed that that Marvel pulled it off. Really, that Kevin Feige pulled it off. It's a real producer's movie. If there weren't DGA rules, who knows if the Russos would be here. But that's another story. My question for you is that, like, with all this high praise, eventually we're going to get to the end of the year, and people are going to be like, well, if Avengers Endgame was so good, why are we not nominating it for an Oscar? How good does it have to be great? One of the best movies of the year? And I find myself kind of reluctant to put it in that category, even though I really enjoyed it quite a bit. And I don't know why I feel that reluctance, but it doesn't – Endgame hasn't sat with me in a way where I'm like, it's amazing. It's incredible. It's like one of my favorite movies of the year. I really, really enjoyed it, but I'm not sure what it would need to cross that threshold. I mean, obviously Black Panther made the cut this year, but that movie does feel like on a slightly different level, at least with the artistry involved. But why is Avengers Endgame Oscar material, best movie of the year material? Or if it's not, why?
I mean, I'm a big fan of giant movies being up for Best Picture, so I, you know, go for it, like run that campaign. But I think with this movie and all the Avengers title movies, the machinery is too visible. It's too clearly the product of a whole bunch of other big factors and not an artistic vision. Like,
give it an Emmy
to the Russos for what they've been put together.
There is no chance this movie will be nominated for Best Picture. I think it's their only possible shot at an above the line nomination is for Robert Downey Jr. But I think it's very unlikely.
Although he did get nominated for Tropic Thunder, so weirder things.
I think this would be weirder, actually, in some ways. But I think that, in addition to everything Katie said, there is not an interest in rewarding this movie on that level for Hollywood. I think that this is the last movie that the people who are trying to call attention to the artistry in film really want to reward. Black Panther did something categorically different. And unlike the literary success of The Return of the King, which was, you know, all three installments were nominated for Best Picture. They were all a much tighter, less monolithic thing. They were all better by many, many categories. I think that was a different story.
And more of an individual vision.
Yes. I don't think that this gets anywhere close, but that won't stop Disney from spending a lot of money on it.
Not Best Picture, and maybe not any of the technical Oscars either, because I could think of like three movies off the top of my head that are going to have equivalent competitive visual effects, sound editing, and all of that.
Wow.
What are they? Don't tease
down
me.
Stop pretty far down the road.
Yeah. What?
There's going to be Rise of Skywalker, obviously. You're going to have Disney is going to want to throw VFX behind Lion King, if anything.
Meow.
And then I still think that for sound editing, we're going to see a surprise nomination for
Cats.
Godzilla King of the Monsters. You got to have 17 different giant kaiju sounds and then 11 going, ee! I think it might.
This will never happen, but I think that if Disney were really gunning for a Best Picture nomination for Star Wars, which I'm pulling out of my ass, I think they could actually get that Lord of the Rings spot maybe as a nomination, not a win. Now that there are 9 or 10 nominations, however many they're going to be, they would screen it for awards groups in that very end of November under like strict embargo.
You're begging. Deals. This is you begging right now, right?
If you want to win a New York Film Critics Circle Award,
show me the movie early.
For reasons,
you'd be screening it early.
For reasons I will explain off pod, that would not personally benefit me. I think it would be interesting.
I think you're onto something though with Robert Downey Jr. Best Actor.
I think that campaign's going to happen.
I've talked to people who are on Gold Derby where they're like, I think this could be a thing. So,
he's going to win a Critics' Choice Award.
Buckle up! Oh my God, yes, Vice Gary Jackson himself will hand him the award.
All right, we're done here.
This is the end game.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week not talking about the Avengers for a while at least. I'm sure they'll find
it. Time for
back.
Pikachu.
There we go. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com, where you can read a lot of great things about Avengers Endgame. I have to admit, did a good job. And I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with friends, or you can go back in time and time theft our old episodes.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find my reviews on IndieWire.com. You can find my catastrophic tweets at David Ehrlich. And you can find all of us on iTunes. Write an iTunes review. We'll read it on the show. You know how that goes. Yeah.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me all over the internet talking about Avengers Endgame, but I pinned a thread to the top there, so you can find all my posts. I'm also writing about Game of Thrones at Thrillist.com and discussing it on the Storm of Spoilers podcast, who we had some predictions proven pretty wrong this week. So this week's episode is going to be fun, trying to regain our spoiler footing.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com, where there are lots of things to read about Avengers and Game of Thrones and many other things. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where we want to hear your answer to this week's lightning round question.
In honor of the Battle of Winterfell, what's your favorite cinematic battle scene?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Like violence, you kill me.